just keep up that tempo. It's the only way that you are going to keep up with what's going on in the world, not just the US Army or even the US military. You must develop an understanding of broader strategic context, and you can only do that through your own self-study. As I say to people, read like your life depends on it, because it probably will. A lot of people who made judgments about the Ukrainians were experts on Russia, and they projected Russian military effectiveness onto the Ukrainians, and that was a huge mistake.
Greetings, and welcome to the Operational Arch, the official podcast of the School of Advanced Military Studies, dedicated to bridging the gap between tactics and strategy through the study of operational art and the operational level of war. I'm Major Josh Bedingfield, here alongside Majors Dan Warner and Kelsey Kurtz. We'll be your hosts today. Today's guest is Australian Army Major General Retired Mick Ryan, a world-respected strategist with service in East Timor, Iraq, and Afghanistan, and author of War Transformed: The Future of 21st Century Great Power Competition and Conflict. He is also a 2003 graduate of the School of Advanced Warfighting.
Welcome, sir, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, mate. It's great to be here.
So when we were putting together the initial episodes and potential guest lists, mutual peer of yours and one of the instructors at SAMS, Dr. Greer, chimed in with one of his big ideas and said, hey, I think we might be able to get Mick Ryan on. And I could try and describe for you the excited faces that Dan and I had at the opportunity to pick your brain, but we were pretty pumped. So we're super excited to have you here.
Thanks. It's good to be here. And I served with Jim in Iraq, and he's someone I'm very fond of personally and professionally.
He's certainly a pretty significant asset to SAMS, the prior director, and anytime he walks into a room, you know you're about to learn something.
Oh, no, he's brilliant.
So, sir, the context for today's episode is you've emerged as one of the most trusted and respected voices evaluating Russia's unjust war in Ukraine. Your well-crafted Twitter threads average thousands of likes and retweets. Your recently published articles in The Economist and Engelsberg Ideas offered timely and disciplined insights into Ukrainian operational design and Russia's worsening strategic dilemmas. In addition, you've kept your eye on Taiwan, an operational system equally as complex. Your analysis regularly evaluates the utilization, for better or worse, of what we would define as tools of the operational artist and the execution of campaigns both pre- and mid-conflict. What we'd like to discuss with you today is the concept of the evaluation and assessment of operational art to determine how students of war might glean lessons, good or bad, on how forces employ operational art well or poorly in real time. So to start off our conversation, sir, our question for all is, would you mind briefly describing for us in the audience your personal definition or theory of operational art?
Sure. I mean, I guess the kind of book definition is it's how you link tactics with strategy. But there's a whole lot of nuance within that, because strategy might be the military type, or it could be something different, to be quite frank, because military organizations don't always do things that just have military outcomes. Sometimes they have different kinds of strategic outcomes across all the elements of national power, especially when it comes to intelligence engagement and those kind of things. So it really is about how tactics link with different kinds of strategies, which then achieve national desired and hopefully favourable outcomes. And then it is clearly bounded. I mean, it's never an unbounded thing, whether it's bounded by geography, time, resources, nationality, a whole range of things can actually bound the planning and the execution of operations and campaign. The final thing I'd say about when you think about defining operational art is there's not one kind of it. I mean, the US has a form of operational art, with COCOMs a very important part of that, but it works at a scale that its operational art is implemented differently than, say, it might be by the Europeans, or it might be Asian nations, or indeed by a smaller country, by my own. So whilst there's some common threads about the linkage from tactics to strategy to policy, how it's done in different countries, whether it's just a process or whether there's organisations or whether there's both, can be quite different depending on, you know, cultures and size and geography and culture.
We had a discussion with Lieutenant General Beagle, commander of CAC, last week, and there was a brief aside where we kind of explored the concept of generating shared understanding within a doctrinal definition. And you just brought up how multinational perspectives might further complicate an effort to generate shared understanding. Do you mind unpacking a little bit some of the lessons that you've learned working alongside the number and scale of multinational nations that you have in your career in seeking to solidify a multinational approach to executing operational arc?
Yeah, I mean, the theory is working with allies makes you stronger. And generally, that does hold. You know, I've worked with some really different kinds of partners on military operations as well as engagement activities. Clearly, worked a lot with the United States Army in Iraq, a bit with the Marines and the other services. Worked a lot with the Indonesians, both in engagement in previous appointments, but also across the border in East Timor in a kind of way. And, you know, also work with third parties that we were training, whether it was Iraqis or Afghans as well, that were kind of partners, kind of who we were training, and then sometimes played different roles as well that weren't as helpful. I think the common theme for me when you're working with partners like this, whether they're allies or just partners for a short period of time, is cultural appreciation, is kind of understand where they're coming from. You know, there is a strong inclination by certain Western military organizations, and, you know, the Australian Army, US Army would probably be in that group, to kind of mirror image, expect that our partners are very similar to us, have shared values, similar cultures, and similar ways of doing business. The reality is that is actually almost never the case. But it, if you appreciate those differences, you understand the reason for them, why, say, the Australian Army and the US Army might think slightly differently on things like amphibious operations or long-range strike or logistics, you can then work together far more productively because you can take the best from both and you can use the full diversity of ideas in a partnership, which is, at least in theory, the superpower of democracies, being able to consider all ideas, the full range of ideas, and then rigorously critique and assess them for their efficacy.
Sir, in a recent article, Tale of Three Generals, How the Ukrainian Military Turned the Tide, we have a question based on that. I'm going to read the quote directly just so the audience has the context. It's not a try to gotcha question with a direct quote from something you wrote. But so you posted, operational design is an important component of the military profession. It is through good operational design that military commanders and their staffs sequence and orchestrate the tactical goals and actions of military forces in the field to meet desired strategic and political outcomes. So I was wondering if you can extrapolate the relationship between operational design and operational art, and how does one shape or influence the other?
Mm. Yeah. No, I think that's a really important question. I mean, design theory over the last decade or two has become quite influential in certain parts of military institutions to inform the conduct of planning and the execution of a range of different activities. I mean, it's design is very much how you kind of confirm the problem. It's kind of the mission analysis for mission analysis, if I could put it really coarsely. But it's deeper than that. You know, design should allow you to kind of scope the problem, scope the kind of ideas that might be required. It's your thinking about thinking that comes before planning. Whereas the operational art encompasses that, it encompasses formal planning, it encompasses execution and the adaptation that's required as part of campaign, both design and execution. So, you know, design is a subset, I think, of the operational art. Both are important. Both should be studied. But, you know, as the Marines always used to say, if I can quote the Marines, you know, we need to be doctrine sound, not doctrine bound when it comes to these things. We use it when it's right for the situation. There may be situations where design is not appropriate. Now, I can't think of too many at the moment, but it could be because of time. It could be because of cultural differences in alliance partners and those kind of things. So I think they're both really important components of how militaries think and conduct activities in war and competition. We need to understand them at both the staff and command level. And I think sometimes commanders don't understand these things well enough or provide sufficient quality input for these things. But they are very important and are a necessary part of the curricula, particularly at mid and senior career courses.
Sarah, thank you so much for that. In that same article, you coined the Ukrainian strategy as one of corrosion. How does a strategy of corrosion differ from one of annihilation or attrition? And if I can add, what Western assumptions do you think that we are overlaying on the Ukrainian operational art?
So I first used this term in an article. I write a weekly article for the Sydney Morning Herald here, which is Australia's biggest newspaper. And I wrote it probably in March, April, I think I wrote this, and I coined this term. And really, this was about a 21st century version of Liddell Hart's indirect approach. That doesn't mean I'm a great fan of Liddell Hart, but some of the stuff he wrote, I think, was certainly worth reading and studying. And, you know, this indirect approach where the Ukrainians have indirectly attacked the Russians through their global information and influence campaign, which has solicited Western diplomatic, military, economic, and humanitarian assistance, has slowly corroded Russia's influence and reputation globally. In the battle space, they have avoided direct or close combat until they have shaped the environment to one that is more favourable to them, whether that's through the use of long-range strikes, not just through HIMARS, but HIMARS have clearly had a massive and positive effect for the Ukrainians and the rest of us, to be frank. But they've tacked the right targets doing so, you know, particularly logistics, transport, command and control hubs, which is degraded command and control. It's made the Russians make silly decisions about tactics. And ultimately, it's corroded the morale of Russian soldiers. So, you know, I told him that corrosion just seemed to be the right term at the time when I was thinking about this. And, you know, at the schoolhouse there, you're taught there's two kinds of strategy, right? Annihilation or attrition. Which one was the war in the Pacific? And that's an important question. And I don't disagree with those classifications. I've been through all that myself. So I have been beaten up a bit, you know, by people saying there's only two kinds of strategy. And it's like, well, maybe in the 21st century, we can rethink this and evolve our conception of strategy, just as the conception of strategy evolved in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, because it broadened and for a whole lot of other reasons. So for me, that's what the strategy of corrosion is: eschew direct confrontation until the conditions are really, really in your favour. The Ukrainians have done that just about for everything except for Donbass in May, June, where they were drawn into fighting how the Russians wanted to. But you can see how the Ukrainians think differently from the Russians, how they don't want to be drawn into fighting how the Russians want to fight. And, you know, I think that's pretty clever. It's not Soviet. It's not NATO. And I think there are too many people out there who have fallen in love with the myth that the Ukrainians have drunk the NATO Kool-Aid about how we fight, how we conduct logistics, the importance of NCOs and those kind of things. The reality is most people who have experience with the Ukrainians will tell you that the Ukrainians are still in the very early stages of any transition to a NATO kind of ethos to having a professional NCO corps. It's really about veterancy rather than NCO ranks in the Ukrainian army. And I think that's actually not a bad approach. They focus on the functions that need to be undertaken by NCOs, not so much a rank system. So, you know, that's a long discussion on the strategy of corrosion and how the Ukrainians think about fighting and have they transitioned to being a NATO force. You know, they're not a NATO force, but they're not a Soviet force, they're not a Russian force, they're a Ukrainian force. And I think that's worthy of study in and of itself.
And so you're absolutely right. That study, as we kind of look at them transition through different types of fighting and overlaying our own assumptions on it, would you change any of your evaluations or assessments that you made in March, given the events over the last few months?
Not really. You know, I, having studied war for 25 years, this was always going to be a tough fight. But I think the Ukrainians have surprised everyone, including me, just how good they've been, just how well they've fought, just how well they've defended. So I think we all need to kind of have a look at our analytical models and look at why that was. I think for a lot of us, including someone like me, it's probably they just didn't know enough about the Ukrainians to make a value judgment. I mean, a lot of people who made judgments about the Ukrainians were experts on Russia, and they projected Russian military effectiveness onto the Ukrainians, and that was a huge mistake. And in doing so, that should allow us to think about our mental models and our assessment methodologies for looking at the PLA and Taiwan, for example, or for any other conflict we might see in the 21st century. There's a range of others we could see. So I think we'd all kind of have a bit of a mea culpa. I didn't think the Ukrainians were going to lie down or anything, but I think everyone has been surprised just how effective they have been, just how courageous the Ukrainian people have been, and just how good they've been at synchronizing and sequencing a range of different offensive activities in the last few months.
So just reflecting a little bit on your answer, sir, when you juxtapose corrosion against annihilation or attrition specifically, I'm seeing a relationship between like linearity and attrition and non-linearity and corrosion, where the depth of the battlefield really comes into play, and the ability to reach behind the forward line of troops and impact those assets that can shape the fight becomes the focus of what is being attrited and is thus potentially inherently different and unique?
I've always been suspect of strategies of attrition. I mean, attrition is what you do regardless of your strategy, right? Close combat is about killing and destroying the enemy. And it doesn't matter whether you're in a strategy of corrosion, annihilation, or a peacekeeping mission. If you're going up against the adversary, armies do one thing, they kill them. That's our job, and that's what our job should be. So, you know, I think sometimes we overthink attrition. You know, we see these news reports about, oh, it's an attritional battle and this. It's like, well, of course it is. That's what battles are. That's what they do. I think, you know, you're better off using the old delineation of maneuver versus methodical approaches, potentially. I think that actually describes better how people think rather than annihilation or attrition. So, you know, I just think attrition is overused. It's actually something that's done constantly by everyone, regardless of whether they're in conflict or competition. I mean, we're constantly trying to attrit the Chinese reputation and their capacity to influence Taiwan, for example. Is that a strategy of attrition, or is it just what we do? So, you know, I think sometimes we can overthink this notion of attrition because it is just a central part of everything that we do. It's not a definitive and standalone strategy that we can write up in an O plan or something and give to the general and say, here you go, let's implement this strategy of attrition.
I think that's very well put, sir. So let's, dialing down into those different strategies, overthought or not, how might a selection of one or binning ourselves into one or the other shape how we execute and employ operational art?
Well, before you select your strategy, there's a lot of other things you've got to do beforehand, right? Clearly, you've got to deeply understand the enemy system, not just its military, but its intelligence collection, its command, its strategic logistics. I mean, if you don't understand that, you're not well placed to go down the pathway of selecting one of these systems. You then need to understand your own system. And amazingly, a lot of people don't even, you know, when you're talking about alliances, a lot of people don't always understand their allies who they're working with. So you've got to understand that first, particularly the political level when it comes to alliances, because regardless of what the principal military member of an ally might want politically, other members may have slightly different political desired outcomes. So, you know, we've seen, World War II is a great study of this, you know, with the Americans and the British, but there are other good case studies. So you've got to understand those two things, and then you've got to understand, well, what are you trying to do here? Are you trying to destroy the Iraqi army in Kuwait, or are you trying to kick the Iraqi army out of Kuwait, or are you trying to collapse the Iraqi government through the destruction of the Iraqi army in Kuwait? And then and only then can you really select what kind of strategy you think will meet that outcome, given what you know about the enemy and what you know about yourself and your alliance.
Here at SAMS, we do these monographs where we research and write, and you were talking so much in line of what I have been working on the last few months that I was just taking notes and listening and got distracted, because I know that Josh would absolutely murder me if I turned this into my own personal research progress.
Hey, you wouldn't be the first to do that, and I'm always always happy to help in that regard. No, I know it's a tough year.
You're really overestimating my lethality.
Yeah, I'm probably underestimating Josh's lethality. I've been calling him Joe for the last few weeks, and I don't even know how I'm still health standing. I'll refocus on our next question. So the elements of operational art are conceptually sound, but observationally and cognitively intangible until declared or determined through planning or analysis. How would you encourage students of war and operational art to train themselves to recognize when elements such as operational reach or culmination have manifested on the battlefield?
Yeah, I mean, that's an important question. I mean, the theory of the operational art, whilst there's been a lot of work done, particularly in the last 20 or 30 years, and, you know, people like Milan Vigo and others have done a lot in this regard, still not as deep as, you know, strategy and tactics is understood in military institutions. And, you know, there's still some people who want to have the debate about, you know, the operational level of war. I mean, you can have that debate. I think it's pretty meaningless, to be quite frank. Most professional military organizations understand you have to link tactics with strategy, and the operational art is how you do it. And whether you do that through process, through organizations, I think this, is there an operational level or not, is kind of a whataboutism kind of talk. So how do you train yourself to recognize element? You know, things like operational reach. I mean, that is about understanding yourself first and foremost. You know, what are you capable of doing? From the political level, what's permissible? From the strategic level, what's your strategic support base? And I talk about support, I'm not just talking about morale, I'm talking about logistics. And that's something that's really come to the fore. That determines your reach. It determines your sustainability for individual parts of any operational plan or campaign. And it determines how quickly you can advance or move across the wide swathes of ocean that we're likely to have to move across in the coming decades. So there's that understanding of yourself. It's also about, there's a bit of mathema operations in this, right? You know, maths is important when it comes to this stuff, you know, not just about correlation of forces, but sustainability and viability periods, about anticipating needs for different kind of rare classes of supply, not just munitions, but, you know, like World War II, World War III in the Pacific is probably going to need a lot of ship-borne carrying capacity. I won't call it amphibious because it's not going to be all amphibious. So these are the kind of things as an operational artist you absolutely have to understand. They will shape operations way more than many, many other considerations. You know, I think World War II is a great case study. The things that shaped the art of the possible when it came to campaigns was not desire from military leaders to do things. It was all about lift. It was all about understanding the enemy and yourself, and it was availability of operational enablers. whether it was communications. For us, it might be information operations, electronic warfare, those kind of things. So, I mean, you've got to school yourself in all these kind of things. You'll get a baseline in it at school, but you've just got to keep reading. And that's all I ever did. I just, you know, I read 3 to 4 hours a day. I still do, to keep myself in the loop with these kind of issues, both with the theory and practice of it. And then you've got to do it. I mean, you will all go to COCOMs after this or something similar to that, headquarters, DA or something. And the way you start to recognize how to do this well is by doing it and making mistakes and doing it in lots of different contextual settings, whether it's Europe or the United States or South America or the Western Pacific or the Southern Pacific. And once you've done it a lot, you start being able to use recognition prime decision making, because you recognize things not just from history books, but from your own experience and the experience of others, which are useful. Culmination is a bit different. You can school yourself all you want, but there's a fair bit of sense, you know, spidey sense that you have to develop through decades of study and experience. And I think, you know, there's no mathematical metric to decide when an enemy's culminated. There's so many intellectual and moral aspects to it that you need to appreciate. So I guess what I'm saying is there's a whole bunch of things involved in developing expertise as a planner and commander who have competency in the operational art. And you've got to do them all. None of them are discretionary if you want to be good at this stuff. And you need to be an expert at the physical, intellectual, and moral aspects of warfighting.
Sir, thank you for that really thoughtful response about developing yourself as an operational planner. I have one question about the culmination with the, you know, schooling yourself and then also sense and experience and having no mathematical metric, like one former combat engineer to another former combat engineer. There's been a lot of discussion about the Russians' use of wet gap crossing early on in the operations, and now what seems to be their hesitancy because of a known culmination with the advanced technology and available technology overlapping on the battlefield. How do you kind of see, how do you see that really influencing wet gap operations, if I can get specific just for 2 minutes of your time, because I know it's a hot topic right now within the U.S. Army Engineer Regiment.
Yeah, I mean, obstacle breach, whether it's wet gaps, dry gaps, any number of obstacles that are covered by observation and fire by an enemy, is a really important ground force capability. For a couple of reasons. Firstly, in generating a force, it is the most complex combined arms activity that you can undertake. There is nothing harder than this. And therefore, it provides an outstanding training tool to develop brigades, divisions, in particular, as excellent combined arms teams. If you can do combined arms obstacle breach, you can do anything as a combined arms team. Indeed, I've been, you know, a brigade I was in, the brigade commander, we spent 2 years just focusing on this because it made us really get to know each other, you know, across the brigade. You know, and that was, you know, we had armor, infantry, engineers, the whole lot in the combined arms brigade. But as a battlefield capability, it's also important. You're always going to have to cross gaps. But I think that the conduct of these things are going to have to be more sophisticated and more joint. I mean, the suppression, right, in SOSRA isn't just about electronic warfare, and it's not just about our own integral medium and long-range fires. The suppression piece is going to have to be deeper physically, but also deeper in the cyber electronic electromagnetic spectrum and other areas when it comes to things like deception and operational security. You know, air mobile operations, you know, used to be reasonably simple, but now they're a full joint package of suppression activities to enable an air mobile operation. And I think combined arms obstacle breaches are going to have to go the same way, because ground doesn't change, right? You've still got to deal with the terrain. If you've got to cross an obstacle, and sometimes you cannot avoid it, you better be able to do it well. And, you know, the biggest obstacles I can see at the moment include the Pacific Ocean, the Coral Sea, and these kind of things. And then there's lots of green bits called islands in the Pacific, 35,000 of them, and many of them have obstacles as well. We're going to have to fight there, and we better be able to do it better than the other guy.
Kelsey, I'm glad you brought this conversation to execution, because that's kind of something I'm thinking about right now between operational design and execution. Is positive or good execution an indicator of good design, or is bad execution mean there was poor design? Can you have good operational design but bad execution?
You sure can. You know, the way I used to learn, I mean, I commanded a combined arms brigade, and the very first day I sat down with my staff and walked them through design, planning, and execution. They were the three elements that as a commander I was going to be center of. And then I walked them through what was my role in each and what I expected from the staff and how I expected them to interact with the seven other battalions in the brigade in each of them. A good design, which doesn't have to take long, and I think largely design is a command responsibility, not just the commander, but it should be the commander talking to his subordinate commanders, isn't just about, you know, shaping objectives, shaping understanding, and providing context. It's also about a commander shaping and listening to the perceptions of subordinate commanders. And I think we miss that sometimes in design. And I think that's really important. Commanders see things that staffs or others don't. They think about things they don't just because of the responsibilities they have. They see the battle space differently. And I always found, you know, at the brigade level, involving my unit commanders at the earliest opportunity underpinned a more effective and more joined up planning process. It gave them earlier warning about operations. So it improved planning, but it also improved execution, because if you had earlier warning and you were better integrated into the overall plan, you were not just better able to execute, but better able to adapt when things change. Because if there's one thing certain about execution, it's not going to go how you plan it. Things are going to change. The enemy's going to react in ways you don't expect. You're going to come up against terrain or shortfalls in logistics or even shortfalls in subordinate commanders that will force you to adapt. I saw the design, planning, and execution as three distinct but interlinked and constantly evolving parts of how a leader should appreciate their role. And, you know, they need to be an integral part of each of them. In execution, you know, the role of the commander and the location of the commander was, I always thought, was vital. You know, for me, having long chats on command nets was not my style. One, because that's how we always targeted, you know, insurgents, because I thought that was stupid to do. But, you know, short, sharp texts once the plan's out there, and B, where the greatest opportunity and greatest threats were kind of what I did as a commander. So, you know, this is an individual style, but it's also about developing trust through, once again, design and planning activities constantly and being out there seeing your leaders in action. The operational art is a little bit more difficult to do that, but I think it's the same principle. You need to be able to walk through each of them and decide as a commander and be very explicit with your staff and subordinate leaders, regardless of their service or speciality, what you expect with them, what input you expect from them, how much you're going to trust them, and where you expect to be during execution, and how you expect to adapt as things change throughout execution.
Yeah, that seems to interplay nicely with our conversation with General Beagle last week about Michigan Command being a dialectic, right? With higher command and subordinate commands. And usually it seems that the way we trip up is at your level, at the company level, when I'm reporting up, you could be absolutely right in what you're seeing, but wrong in the bigger picture. And this, I think it goes into messaging. Hmm. This is it's a dialectic. It's not one person has to be 100% right or another.
And not everyone's capable of mission command. whether it's experience, you know, as a junior platoon leader in your first few months, you are not really capable of that. You are given a little bit of rope, but you are given a little bit of rope, not just because of trust, but the expectation is you make mistakes and that you learn from them. And as you learn from them or demonstrate you can learn from them, you get more rope. But when you demonstrate you can't learn from them, that's when, you know, commanders go, well, maybe this isn't a mission command person. Maybe this is a directive command person. So we also need to understand mission command's not some hold-all that you do everywhere all the time with everybody. There are nuances and there are circumstances where it may just not be appropriate at certain levels with certain experience levels.
Yes, sir, you're absolutely right. At least from my foxhole, I think that Dan and Kelsey would agree that, you know, that rope that you have, however short it is, it's pretty critical for junior leaders to understand and have the courage to use it creatively and take risk within the length that you provided, and also for commanders to encourage their subordinate leaders to do that and make their environments welcome to that innovation and risk taking. But within that relationship of operational art, operational design, and execution, there's this word that Western militaries, particularly the US Army, doesn't really like to discuss, which is the moral component. Kind of just got reintroduced into our new operating concept, MDO, where we recognize that the human domain is a part of, the human dimension, pardon me, is a part of each of the domains that we're operating within in our future operating environments. And I'm just curious on your take on how the moral component might shape that relationship between operational design, good or bad, art, good or bad, and execution, good or bad.
Well, I mean, generating fighting power is about intellectual, physical, and moral components. I mean, it's not new. It's just that we're making explicit so we can reinforce its importance. That's why doctrine like this is so vital, because it's in the schoolhouse. You make sure people understand this, and then in practice they can actually do it, hopefully. I mean, the moral component in influencing the operational art, I think, There's a couple of strands here. I mean, firstly, you need to ensure that when you are planning, you're doing it in accordance with the values of the institution, the values of the country you represent, right? I mean, that's a pretty basic thing, but it's an important part of a moral approach to warfare. Not just the legal piece, which is what you can and can't do, the moral piece, what you should and shouldn't do, is every bit, if not more, important when it comes to, you know, the operational art and campaign planning, I think. Secondly, you know, you want to be degrading the moral component of your adversary, whether it's things to, you know, kill someone there so the person next to him's morale goes down, destroy logistics so they're all hungry and their morale's down, or do things that result in catastrophes on the battlefield for the adversary that degrades morale back home. Sorry, that's my cat in the background. He does this often. So, you know, I think the moral component is extraordinarily important. And, you know, things like in the battle space, you're not just going to have military. You know, our experience is in most operations, even big wars, there's always going to be displaced persons, whether friendly or enemy. And how you treat them is part of the moral component of war fighting. Prisoners of war. Clear direction on aligning with the conventions of the treatment of prisoners of war are really important. Clearly the Ukrainians have done this and the Russians are probably given different guidance on the treatment of prisoners of war. All of these are elements of the moral component of operations and the operational art, and you know we forget these or underrate them or push them to annexe at our peril, because at the end of the day it'll be the moral component that provides the purpose for what we're doing at just about every level, and we should never forget that.
Sir, that's an excellent point. I think that's a good place to close the conversation. Thank you so much for your time. Do you have any closing words for the audience? And what can we expect from you next? And where's the best place to follow your current work?
Well, firstly, it's a real honor to be on this. I mean, SAMS is an amazing institution with, you know, great students and teachers constantly. I've got a lot of friends who are graduates in the US Army and in the Australian Army, and they speak highly of it. So thank you so much. You know, I'd say to students there that, you know, you think you're reading a lot now, and you are, you know, it's a book a day club, right? Keep doing it. When you leave, just keep up that tempo. It's the only way that you are going to keep up with what's going on in the world, not just the US Army or even the US military. You must develop an understanding of broader strategic context, and you can only do that through your own self-study. And as I say to people, read like your life depends on it, because it probably will. And it gives you sources of knowledge, and as Jim Mattis said, a light when things are dark, whether it's in how to think, but even just with your own morale and keeping your head up in front of your subordinates. What's next for me? You know, we're all, I guess, following the great Twitter, whatever it is at the moment. I won't call it a meltdown, but, you know, clearly it's something that's being paid way too much money for by an entitled man-child who is now doing everything he can to destroy the value in what has become a global village discussion place, and I think has an important role in PME and generating diverse views. If we use it correctly. So, you know, I've got a Substack now. I'm trying Mastodon, which I think is a total waste of time. It's if Twitter is a global audience, Mastodon is four people sitting around a campfire in an isolated valley singing Kumbaya. So I don't see a lot of value in it for us, but particularly not for a military audience trying to communicate and share ideas. Post seems to be okay, but I'm going to persevere with Twitter for a little while yet, and keep using it in the hope that we might turn this boat around and put it on a better course. Book coming out next year on Taiwan. It's called White Sun War. You can order that on Casamate. It's, if you've ever read Killer Angels, it's same style as that. It's a fictional account from 10 years in the future, looking back at a campaign over Taiwan. One of the central characters is a young US Army captain who commands a cavalry troop, and her cavalry troop is a human-machine teaming one full of robotic systems, and it happens to be attached to a Marine Littoral Regiment. I've done that mainly because I love both the Marines and Army, and Smith versus Smith shouldn't come between you anymore. So that'll come out first half of next year. But, yeah, I'm just watching, reading, analyzing what's going on in Ukraine, but also in the Western Pacific, because I think it behoves us all to have that strategic understanding.
Sir, thank you. And thank you to the audience for listening. This is the Operational Arch.
This has been an official publication of the School of Advanced Military Studies. The views and expressions heard here are those of the authors and do not reflect the official position or opinions of SAMS, the U.S. Army, or the U.S. government. Stay up to date on all things SAMS and the Operational Arch by following us on Twitter at US_SAMS. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to or follow the podcast. Additionally, if you have recommendations for an episode, send any proposals to operationalarch@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.